How many of you have ever had at your work, maybe at a school, but usually at a job, like a job performance review, some sort of meeting where they kind of tell you like if you were doing a good job or not, and what you were good at? So how many of you, yep, okay, I see the accountable's digital hand, good work on using that. All right, so we have those at Wooddale where we every year have our annual review as to here are some areas that we like to see all of our employees doing well in, and how does this work, and what parts of your job are you good at, what parts could you improve on. And so there are many times where we go into those reviews and we think, okay, you know, it's been a great year or a month or however long it is that you're being reviewed for. And you show up, and the person that's a manager over you is telling you all sorts of stuff that you were totally unprepared to hear about either your communication skills or your organizational skills, or they think that you're late all the time, and you're just like unprepared to hear that kind of critique. And so it can be hard when we go into a meeting thinking we're here, and some review systems are even like this, where like you evaluate yourself and then your manager evaluates you, and then you try and reconcile the differences. And in this section, Paul is talking about evaluating our leadership, and as he does that, Paul is going to say, how do I evaluate myself? Because here is the issue here in the Corinth church. At the beginning, he's addressing divisions, and then first specifically a division over Christian leaders. There were these people in the churches in Corinth are arguing about which leader they're following, whether it be Paul because he's the first one that brought the gospel into Corinth and started their church, or whether it be Apollos because they like his speaking style, or whether it be Peter because he was more or less the like original Christian that people were rather listen to, or they liked him because he was a much more normal person. Paul and Apollos were both heavily educated. Peter was just some fisherman who like just told it like it was. He just said, you know, Jesus is God. I saw him do all this stuff. I walked on water with Jesus, okay? And that's the kind of person Peter was. That's not to say that he also didn't say things in a confusing way, but some people just like that kind of teaching and style and leadership. And so the church in Corinth was dividing up about which leader they liked. And they were all evaluating these Christian leaders based on different criteria, whether it be how they knew the person, what they thought about the person, how they spoke, whether they were well liked in the general society or not. They were just picking people and evaluating them based on their own set of criteria. In this section, Paul's going to say that their criteria was way off as far as evaluating Christian leaders. He has already addressed prior that all of those Christian leaders that they're arguing about would be all in agreement that they're basically nothing, that really they're just trying to do their job, and that it doesn't matter who tells you the gospel gets its power from the Spirit of God, and that is what should be the uniting power of the gospel to unite these believers despite their differences of opinions as to which speaker they like to hear or which school of thought they follow the easiest or the best. He said that in the section right before that he laid the foundation, and whoever builds on it, and that's not just Apollos who came in afterwards and was teaching the people in Corinth about the gospel and this whole story of the Bible and how everything pointed to Jesus, but it also was talking to the people in the Corinth church about how are they building on the foundation that was laid, because the foundation is immovable, because the foundation is Jesus. That is it. What he did in his life, death, burial, resurrection, and ascension into heaven, all is the foundation that cannot be moved. If you build on anything else, it's going to fall apart. But even though you have a sure foundation, you can start building with a whole bunch of useless materials that will also cause damage to the temple of God, which in this section of Corinthians, he's referring to the united body of believers there in Corinth and throughout the world. So let's start in verse 18 for our section today about what Paul is going to tell the Corinthian believers about how they ought to be evaluating their Christian leaders and their spiritual advisors in their life. Verse 18, he says, "No one should deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks he is wise in this age, he must become foolish so that he can become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, since it is written, 'He catches the wise in their craftiness.' And again, the Lord knows that the reasonings of the wise are meaningless." Here, Paul is bringing back into the discussion and reminding them of what he had said prior, that the message of the cross is foolishness to people who do not believe. And so if you are finding yourself viewed as someone who is wise by a whole bunch of people who do not believe the gospel, not just wise in general or wise in a specific area, like you could be considered a wise basket weaver, but if you're considered wise as it comes to the spiritual aspects of the world by people who don't believe the gospel, Paul says you should first consider maybe you need to be willing to become a fool. Because if you find yourself wise in this age, you need to become foolish that he can become wise, because the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. So what Paul is saying is, look, when you're following after God, if you're telling people the message of what God has done for them, get used to the fact that you're going to be treated like you're an idiot. It's really okay, because with God, the wisdom of this world, the best theories, the best notions as to where we came from, why are we here, what are we doing, what's happening next, all of those best wise world systems of religion is foolishness in God's eyes. So if you are going to be a believer, if you believe that God sent Jesus to die for you so that you could go to heaven to live with him forever, be prepared to be treated like you're a fool. Because in this world, God is going to use what things seem to be foolish to confound the wise. And so then Paul says, as it is written, God catches the wise in their craftiness, and the Lord knows that the reasonings of the wise are meaningless. He says God already knows everything that the world thinks, why they think it, how they think it, and how we can overlook the holes and inconsistencies in our worldviews. And it says that God catches them in their craftiness. So God, all being all-knowing, not only knows what we're thinking, but he knows the truth, and he knows what the world is going to do with the things that they believe. And so he catches them in their craftiness, in the system of this world that they're trying to make that's inconsistent with the world that he made from the beginning. He is going to be able to catch them in their argument, in their worldview, and say, like, you can't even work out your whole worldview correctly. There are these trap points in your thinking. And he says that the Lord knows that the reasonings of the wise are meaningless, that they're incapable of making good arguments that lead to good conclusions, that lead to good and godly living. The smartest people in the world who have ever existed, if they do not follow after God, God looks at them and says, wow, how foolish is their worldview? Because they believe that I am nothing. And yet God sits in the heavens and he laughs, as the Bible says, about how we as his created beings, trying to be his representatives here on earth, just kind of look up and say, there's no God. I'm the biggest and most important being there is. And God just looks at the world and shakes his head and says, that's not even the case. Your thinking is meaningless. So Paul starts off this section with a reminder that the Corinthian believers shouldn't want to be the most popular or considered to be the smartest or the wisest. And this sure seems, because Paul keeps bringing it up and bringing it up again, one of the major reasonings behind why they're dividing over leaders is trying to say that this leader is going to give me better recognition, because if I say I follow Peter, and not Apollos, people are going to look at me and say, oh, so you learned everything you know about spiritual things from a fisherman who's never really gone to school in his life. So he reminds them that the being considered wise by the world, by unbelieving people, is not the goal, is not the reason we believe the gospel in the first place. And so then he draws this conclusion in verse 21. So no one should boast in human leaders, for everything is yours. So he says here that, as he has mentioned before, you shouldn't be boasting about human leaders, because it's not the human leaders that have been able to save you. It's not the power of the gospel coming from the person you heard the gospel from. It's coming from the Spirit of God that, by the way, lives in you. So he says you shouldn't be boasting in human leaders, because everything is yours. Now, what does that mean? There's lots of different opinions about everything is yours, but he encapsulates some stuff in between to give examples of what is theirs. It says, for everything is yours. And I think best way to take that is everything's already yours. You don't need human leaders to get you anything. You already have everything that you're expected to have. So then he says, so no one boasts in human leaders, because everything is yours. And he says, so don't boast in human leaders like Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world. Don't boast in life or death or things present or things to come. He says, don't boast in any of the stuff that you need more of in order to have what you need. It sure seems like the Corinthians were trying to fill a void that the Spirit was supposed to be filling in their hearts and in their lives and how they make decisions, but they just keep throwing more stuff in here, trying to fill that void instead of listening to the Spirit, which is the power of the gospel to save them and to unite them. They decided what they needed was a really good, articulate Christian leader, or what they needed to know was what was going to bring them the best case in their life, or what was going to bring about the best outcome, what was going to make them the most popular. And so Paul says, you shouldn't be boasting in human leaders. You shouldn't be worrying about which one you follow, which school you are, because it doesn't matter, because you already have everything that you need. And so he repeats that in the end of verse 22. He says, everything is yours, because in verse 23, you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. Now, we can get really screwed up here in our Trinitarian theology if we try too hard, if we read too much into this. But what Paul is saying is everything already belongs to the Corinthian believers. Whether or not they have a popular, articulate Christian leader or not, the Christian believers, the individual Corinthians, already have everything that they need, because they belong to Christ directly. The human leader isn't the bridge between the Corinthian believers and Jesus. The human leader is simply there, as he will say in these next couple of verses in chapter 4, as a servant, as a steward, or a manager. The human leaders aren't the bridge. Christ is the bridge between us and God, as it says that you belong to Christ and Christ belongs to God. We don't need the Christian leaders to fill in a gap. We don't need someone who's another person in between us and Jesus, and then Jesus goes to God. We have direct access to Jesus, and Jesus brings us before God. So Paul says, like, this whole argument, this whole issue of division is insane. Corinthian believers, you have missed it by a mile, because it doesn't matter, first of all, who it is that you like the most as far as who's teaching you. That doesn't matter. Second of all of us are in agreement. We all say the same thing, just slightly different ways. We all believe that we are co-workers together with God. We all are just servants. And then he says, it really is absurd that you guys are splitting up over this, because it's not like your Christian leader is the priest between you and Jesus. Jesus is your priest between you and God. The whole lifting up of Christian leaders by the Corinthian church has corrupted their view of what Jesus is doing. And Paul says, you already have everything you need because you belong directly to Jesus. So then, hearing that, right, you could then believe, like Paul is saying, so Christian leaders are completely and utterly unimportant. We don't need them. They should all just disappear, and we don't need them for anything because we already have everything we need. So, which is why then he starts in chapter 4 about what should we then consider as far as Christian leaders. How should we think about them? Because obviously the Christian church in Corinth has elevated Christian leaders too far. And in some other churches, Paul would tell the churches that you don't esteem your pastors or leaders or elders or deacons enough. Like, you don't listen to them. You think that they're nothing, and you should be afraid of that. But in Corinth, he's saying you guys are elevating Christian leaders way too far. So where is the balance, Paul? So let's jump into chapter 4. Verse 1, it says, a person should consider us in this way. And the reason he's using us here is because he's in the list of Christian leaders that the church is splitting themselves over, Paul, Apollos, and Cephas. He says, you should consider all of us this way. So this is the right way to think about Christian leaders. That we are servants of Christ and managers or stewards of God's mysteries. In this regard, it is expected of managers that each one of them be found faithful. Let's start with just those two verses. Paul says, as he's already more in-depth explained previously, is that Paul and Apollos and Peter are all just servants. That is how they ought to be viewed. So, you know, it's hard for us in 21st century America to understand the servant relationship. I'm not even going to pretend like I understand it correctly, but there are some basics that we should consider when Paul is saying you should consider us to be servants of Christ and managers or stewards of God's mysteries. First of all, is being a servant a place of elevated status? Like, did people go around in the Roman Empire hoping that one day they would get to be a servant? Not usually. Usually, servants are things that are of a lower status than even a normal free person, not even someone who is rich or even a Roman citizen or someone who is able to just own their own business. Servants are a, like, low class. And I know in America we don't like to talk about that, and that's understandable. But as Paul is writing this, this is the world in which he lives in that says, like, you should consider us as servants. It's not a position of elevated status. Servants were people who just did whatever they were told by the person that ruled over them. So in some ways, not all, but in some ways it's kind of like having a boss and you're doing whatever the boss tells you to do. But it was definitely much more a lifestyle than a 9-to-5 thing back in the Roman Empire. So he says, first of all, you need to consider us as servants of Christ, which, if you know anything about Paul, is something that he would say about all believers. Right, is that we're all servants of Christ. But Paul is dealing with this issue of Christian leadership being elevated too much, and so he says, to address that problem more directly, that you should consider that Christian leaders ought to be servants of Jesus, not world-famous speakers. And not to say that, like, again, our world is different than theirs, but that's not to say that, like, you can't ever be well-known as a Christian leader and be honoring to God. But he's saying, like, you shouldn't expect that from every individual Christian leader. I think there was pressure in the Corinthian church that the pastor or pastors or whoever would be of the same caliber of Peter, Paul, or Apollos. That's who they really wanted to be their pastors, were these people. And so they were trying to elevate that up so much so that they weren't able to settle for someone who wasn't Peter, Paul, or Apollos. So he says, first of all, you got to consider all of us, Paul, Apollos, Peter, as servants of Jesus. We're not elevated. We're not the most important. We're not even part owners. We just are servants. We do what Jesus says. Okay? And Jesus told us to go tell the world about him and about what he has taught us. And then he says, and as managers of God's mysteries. And I think I don't want to get too far into for sure, like, this is the big difference, but Paul is saying here, like, even in the world of being servants, there are positions of leadership where you're still a servant. And again, really hard to think of in our day and age, but I think if you think, like in England, right, you would have a household full of servants and you'd have all of these different positions, and then, like, you'd want to be the butler. If you were going to be a servant, butler was like the best position you could have, right? And so what Paul is saying is, think of us like this. First of all, we're servants, but we're just managers. It's not even like the best position you could have, but we've been given a job to oversee. Like, we don't get told, go dust this clock, and then go dust the clock and then come back. It's like, I have been given the task of making sure that this area is taken care of. And so we should consider Christian leaders as servants, first of all, a humble position, not one of elevated status where we should expect them to be rock stars. But also we should give them a bit of respect because they are in a position of leadership even though they're servants. They have been given the job of managing, overseeing, showing other people the mysteries of God from the Word of God, about how the whole story of the Bible talks about Jesus. And so here he's kind of balancing it out. He says, somewhere in here, you got to consider us like servants, but you're not going to treat us like we're the worst servants, but we're also not the best servants in the world, but you do need to give us some level of respect and listen to it because we are the managers or stewards of God's mystery. So in this regard, so he says, so because you're thinking of us this way, if you start thinking of us this way, how do you evaluate Christian leaders? How do you evaluate people that you like to listen to? How do you evaluate whether or not you should follow after certain Christian leaders? And he says, so in this regard, if you're going to consider all Christian leaders as servants and managers of God's word, it is expected of managers that each one of them be found faithful. This is how you ought to evaluate them, not based on if you like their speaking style, not based on how well they're liked or how big their church is, not based on whether or not you like their accent, but based on if they are faithful in doing the task that they have been given. I think that this is something that the Corinthian church probably hadn't considered when it came to evaluating church leaders. And it's often something that we might neglect to think about as well when we consider church leaders, whether it be pastors or Sunday school teachers or missionaries or any number of Christian leadership positions, is are we considering, are these people faithful to the job that they have been given? So Paul says you should be expecting from managers that they are faithful. But what does faithful mean? What does it mean to be faithful as a manager of God's mysteries? Many people will use the word faithful to mean like you show up at every meeting, you're the first one there, last one out. Faithful meaning we like what you think and do. But we often have this hard time of understanding this term of faithfulness. What does it mean for a spiritual leader to be faithful? I think it's easiest if we consider what things are not faithful, and by that way we'd be able to evaluate at least in some part the things that are faithful. It is not faithful to change every day and decide to do and teach something different. And this is something that was a big problem in the early church, where people would start speaking and become well-known speakers, they'd be leaders, and then they would change their theology. They would stop talking about Jesus as the Son of God. They would stop talking about the resurrection. They would stop teaching anything that they got laughed at for and just change. That is not a faithful manager, one that just simply like changes everything based on the way the wind is blowing. It is not faithful if one person decides I'm going to do this for like a month and then I'm going to take like 6 months off and do absolutely nothing in relationship to the job that God has given to me. It is not faithful for someone to be not being able to be depended on. It is faithful for someone to show up time and time again, over and over again, to do what they have been asked to do. We can go on and on, and I think probably best way to do it would be to talk about this in our breakout rooms after service today, is what does it look like to be faithful to the job that God has given to us, and what does it look like to not be faithful? And ask ourselves, by what metrics are we evaluating Christian leaders? And then, as Paul will tell us in the section next week, how are we evaluating ourselves? So if you need to, you can treat this like it's just about me and Michael for this week. But then next week, I'm going to tell you that it's about you too. So if you need a week to make this easy and practical, ask yourselves, what does it look like for Michael and Caleb to be faithful to the job that they have been given? By what metrics do we evaluate them on their faithfulness, not on necessarily, although we do appreciate the feedback, on their speaking styles and content and leadership styles? How do we evaluate if they are faithful or not? Because this is what is required of people who are managers, and this obviously brings to mind the parable of the talents, where the master gives different numbers of talents to his three servants and tells them, hey, go use this, make money, right? The first two do. They go and risk it in the marketplace, and they get some profit back. And the third one said, I'm not doing that. I'm just going to put it in the ground. And the master comes back, and he says to these to the first two, well done, good and faithful servants. You did what I asked you to do. While I was gone, you went to work making this money, make more money. And then he gets to this third one, and the third one's like, well, I knew that you would expect really big results from me, and I couldn't handle the pressure, so I just put it in the ground so I wouldn't lose it, because I didn't want to lose the little bit of money that you gave to me. And he says, you wicked servant. I mean, if you weren't going to do anything, at least put it in the bank. At least try and do the job I asked you to do, which was to invest this money, and you didn't do anything. You just put it in the ground. It's not going to be worth more when I come back. This is the metric by which God evaluates Christian leaders, and we ought to as well, is if they are faithful. Do they show up every time, not every day necessarily, but every time they show up and do the same job that they've been asked to do, time and time and time and time and time and time and time again? Or do they get bored and move on, or try and radically change things because they're not sure that they like that mundane nature of doing the same task over and over and over again? This is what Paul is saying you should evaluate Christian leaders to be. And I think he's saying, I know the pastors in Corinth. They are faithful. They have been doing this over and over and over again, coming to you, telling you how the gospel ought to change the way you live, and you guys are not hearing any of it because they're not Paul. They're not Apollos. They're not Peter. And Paul is saying, you should be respectful of your Christian leaders that are faithful, that are willing to come every week to a church like yours, where you're divided over issues, where there are sin rampant throughout your church, and these pastors are coming every week to tell you what God expects from you. Then in verse 3, he says this, it is of little importance to me that I should be evaluated by you or by any human court. In fact, I don't even evaluate myself. For I'm not conscious of anything against myself, but I am not justified by this. The one who evaluates me is the Lord. And again, this is a really confusing Paul-like sentence where he says, I don't really think much about what you guys think about me. Like, that's not what's on the forefront of my mind. I'm not worried about the grades you're giving me on my public speaking or on what you think about me. Doesn't really matter to me the way you evaluate me in any other area other than faithfulness. I don't think about it that much. It's not that important to me that I'm evaluated by you or by any other group of people. That doesn't bother me. As a manager of God's mysteries, the way you evaluate me is not my primary concern. In fact, he says, I don't even judge myself in those areas. I don't make it important about all of these things that you're trying to choose Christian leaders based on. He says, I don't know of anything against me, like that I know that I'm doing wrong. Obviously, if I did, I would be changing it. He says, but that doesn't make me cleared or justified by this. But he says, this is the thing that does matter to me, is that the one who does evaluates is the Lord. He said, the way that I do my life, I'm not walking around wondering, what do people think about me? Or trying to build an image of myself publicly of how I think of myself inside. But instead, he says, I am more concerned that when God comes to evaluate me, that he finds out that I was faithful to the job he gave me. That I wasn't going around doing my own thing the majority of the time and then on some certain days deciding that I was going to do what he wanted. I want the Lord, my master, to come to me as his servant, as his steward, and say, you are faithful. Good job. Then in verse 5 is his warning to the Corinthian church. He says, therefore, don't judge anything prematurely before the Lord comes, who will both bring to light what is hidden in darkness and reveal the intentions of the hearts. And then praise will come to each one from God. He says, don't be hasty to trash people who are not as cool or as popular as the Christian leaders that you like. Do not be hasty to say, oh, these people aren't worth listening to because I don't like this, or I don't like the way they speak or the way their church looks or functions. But instead, we should allow God, who is the master. We often try and elevate ourselves up and over each other, and it's this constant tug of war. Pastors are trying to elevate themselves higher than the church. The church is trying to say, hey, get back in your place because you're not the most important person here. We're in charge because we're congregationalists or whatever. And instead, we should all remember, humbly remember, that we belong to Jesus, that he is the one who gets to judge and pass out rewards. As Paul says here, that when we finally come to meet with Jesus, he will reveal the things that are hidden in darkness and the heart intentions of his people. And that is another reminder of what we talked about last week, about each one's work has to be tested by fire. And the only one that can do that is God. So don't hold your evaluation, your opinion about Christian leaders as the law. Because much to our surprise and to our dismay, there may be several well-known Christian leaders that when Jesus comes back are revealed to have done all of their ministry work in an effort to just evaluate themselves. In fact, as it was in the first century, I believe it would be the case for the rest of our human history, that some of these Christian leaders actually will turn out to not be Christians. And the only one who can dictate how those people are to be judged is God. So we need to be careful when we evaluate Christian leaders, pastors, missionaries, all of these different places and of people, and, as Paul will say, each other, to hold our evaluation, our report card, loosely. Because ultimately, the only one that matters is the evaluation by God. And so there will be those who are revealed in darkness that the intentions of their heart were not pure. But the reverse is true as well. This unknown person who has just faithfully tried to lead his family, his church, whatever group of people of influence he has, time and time again, will be given a great reward and praise from God and said, well done, good and faithful servant. You did exactly what I asked you to do. You didn't try and make yourself bigger than the task I gave you. You didn't try to make yourself more important. You just did what I asked you to do. So for us, we need to be wrestling with the fact that although there are preferences, although I understand I had plenty of teachers, I didn't like their classes because of their voices or their teaching style or their tests or whatever the case might be, that is not ultimately how we ought to evaluate spiritual leaders. The metric God gives us is by one's faithfulness, by their dedication to doing perhaps the same thing for year after year after year. That is what God expects from his servants. That's what God expected from Paul, Apollos, and Peter. That's what God expects of the Corinthian church. That's what God expects of us. That we hold true to the job that he has given to us, that we don't question every move that, of that thing and say, well, God, I really want to be famous, so like, could you work that into the schedule? Or like, I really want to be well known, or I want to be the leading voice on this issue, or I want to be known in my workplace as this kind of a person. We should just be satisfied with the fact that we belong directly to Jesus, and whatever Jesus wants us to do, if it means staying home and leading our families and doing the same thing over and over and over again, dealing with the same sin issues in ourselves and in our family over and over and over again, that we take great joy in the fact that we're serving Jesus, and that the metric by which he is going to evaluate us is not on the outcomes, it's not on what our effectiveness was, but simply that we engaged in the task that he gave us. So then asking ourselves this question, what is the task as God's servant that I ought to be doing, dedicating myself to? And in America, we're often told dream big, think big, and I don't want to ever downplay the fact that God is a very big God that can do many different miraculous things. But like, don't think like the Corinthian church that you have to do something big and powerful and world-changing in order for God to evaluate you as a good servant. Ask yourself, what is the task? Where am I? What's the location in which God has told me to be faithful? And am I willing to do that, even if it seems boring, mundane, or too difficult? Am I willing to just be faithful to attempting the task that he has assigned to me and allowing the results and the judgment of whether I did what I could, I did my best at this task, leaving that just to Jesus? Next week, we'll continue in chapter 4, where Paul reminds these believers in Corinth that it's not just the leaders that are the issue, it's themselves too, that they think of themselves much too highly and that they need to understand their rightful place in God's plan as servants as well. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for the book of 1 Corinthians, for a church that's in great conflict, that's divided over issues, that is uncertain as to how to function properly, how to evaluate Christian leaders or evaluate themselves. We thank you for the example of Paul and Peter and Apollos, of Christian leaders that were not concerned with their own personal reputation because they knew what their reputation was, so that the world considered them to be fools. Maybe fools that were of great risk to the government or to other people, and they were targeted, but that they were simply willing to do the task that you had given to them, to go throughout all of these different cities to spread the news of your son to the world. We ask that you would help us be faithful to the task that you've given to us. And although we often like to think that all of us will be these big, great, big, powerful influencers, that you might just be asking us to be faithful with what you've given to us already, to do our best at leading our families, ourselves, each other as believers, as part of your body here on earth, that we would be faithful to this task, to following you, to becoming more like your son, and to be telling the world about what you have done for us. We ask that we would learn to put the metric of faithfulness above all of these other concerns that we may have, that we would learn to see ourselves and each other and Christian leaders as you see them, as your stewards, as your managers of your word here and now, faithfully accomplishing the tasks that they have been given. We ask that your Spirit would help us this week to understand the tasks that we are to do, that we would say yes, and that we would follow and obey your Spirit's calling to us this week as we live in a fallen world, a broken world, in a world filled with confusion right now, that we would know at least that we belong to you and that we are to do what you have asked us to do, and that you've given us everything. We don't lack anything that we need in order to do what you've asked of us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.